All right, tonight we are discussing two articles, one by Sherry Turkle called The Flight from Conversation, published in the New York Times a while back, and an older article by Roger Scruton called Hiding Behind the Screen. Both articles can be found on our website. So the reason we're discussing them is together is because they are on the same theme, namely the threat posed by the kind of virtual relationships made possible by modern technology, things such as text messaging, Facebook, Twitter, and God knows what. Now, these two articles are especially interesting for us, for the Personalist Project, because they are deeply personalist in nature. They focus on the question of how these technologies affect our personhood, our interiority, or how we think of and relate to ourselves, and also our interpersonal relationships, whether those relationships are real, whether they foster genuine trust and communion, etc. As Turkle writes, these technologies change not only what we do, but also who we are. And one more note before beginning to discuss the articles is that they focus mainly on the negatives, but I don't think either author can fairly be called a technological Luddite. Neither Sherry Turkle nor Roger Scruton denies the benefits that these technologies bring. In fact, both of them clearly make extensive use of them, and very good use of them. They experience the benefits of these technologies. But what they try to point out in these articles is the strong tendency inherent in these new technologies to weaken our personal selfhood and to replace genuine, real relationships with superficial and illusory relationships. So that's the danger of which they are aware, the danger that they encounter in their students and other people in culture in general, and that's what they want to point out. The benefits are taken for granted. Now, I hope you'll find the time to read the articles for yourself. They're very much worth it. They're rich, suggest many topics for further reflection and discussion, and a short summary I'll try to give, or the points I take out of them, are by no means all there's there. So try to read them when you get a chance. I will just go over some of the points they make by way of introduction and in an attempt to get the conversation going. But that's all I want to do. I will begin. So the main part of the introduction will be simply going through a number of contrasts between traditional face-to-face conversations, or you could call them in-the-flesh relationships, or real relationships, if you like, and the kind of virtual connections that are made possible by modern technology. All right, so just a number of contrasts, and I'll begin with the more obvious ones, and then as we go on, they become perhaps a little less obvious, I don't know. So the first contrast is simply this, that a face-to-face conversation is much richer than a virtual one. And that's simply because it's not limited to words. A much more real and immediate and intimate contact is established by being in the presence of another person, bodily in the presence of another person. So a lot is communicated through the language of the body. Think of posture, whether a person slouches or sits straight, whether he looks bored or looks interested, and so on. Facial expressions, tone of voice, etc. And also much is gained by witnessing the way in which another person receives and responds to a particular communication. You know, when you say something and the other person, you can see in the face whether he got it or whether maybe he's confused and you need to put the same thing in a different way, and or somebody can be excited or not be excited, and so on. So there are ways in which the response of another person is given in a face-to-face conversation, and it shapes the conversation and enriches it in many ways. There's another way, and this is, I make a contrast too, even though in some ways a similar point, another way in which real relationships, bodily relationships, you could say, are richer than virtual ones, and that has to do with the fact that they can be practical. I mean, I can bring a person a beer, say, when I'm in his presence. You know, you can shake hands, you can embrace, or you can help them. You know, you can help them fix a flat, or you can physically be a shoulder they cry on, and so on. So Roger Scruton mentions this one more than Terkel, and I'll just read a passage to bring home this point. He says, "Real friendship shows itself in action and affection. The real friend is the one who comes to the rescue in your hour of need, who is there with comfort in adversity, and who shares with you his own success. This is hard to do on the screen. The screen, after all, is primarily a locus of information, and only a place of action insofar as communication is a form of action. Only words, and not hands or the things they carry, can reach from it, from the screen, to the comfort of the sufferer, to ward off an enemy's blows, or to provide any of the tangible assets of friendship in a time of need. Friendships that are carried out primarily on the screen cannot so easily be lifted off it, and when they are so lifted, there's no guarantee that they will take the strain." So in the last lines there, he indicates that practical dimension is not only a real part of face-to-face communication and of relationships in the body, they also make particular demands on such a relationship, and they make the relationship harder. Not all virtual relationships could endure, could take the strain, as he puts it, of becoming real and practical in a physical sense. All right, so that's another way in which face-to-face relationships are richer than virtual relationships. A third contrast both Scruton and Terkel make is that virtual connections are extremely easy to make, whereas a face-to-face conversation takes usually a lot of effort. It means that you have to make a date, you have to find and free up some time that's mutually convenient. You have to travel often to a pub or to someone's home. You have to make arrangements, find babysitters, and so on. We all know, I think, you know, what the efforts involved. We know the drill. Modern life in particular, I think, because of the car and because of suburbs and all sorts of things, has made it very hard for people to get together regularly with friends and family. And I think this factor, even though it's not stressed by Terkel and Scruton, I think it's huge. In fact, in some ways, it's probably the most important reason why so many people turn to the internet or to text messaging and so on to keep in touch. They know it's not ideal. They wish they could get together. But this is all they can manage, and it sure is better than nothing. All right, so the effort involved is very different, and that's a third contrast. The fourth contrast is that face-to-face conversations normally take a lot more time. They're longer than virtual connections. A face-to-face conversation needs time to unfold and often requires our patience. You know, you welcome a person, you make him a cup of coffee. You sit down, you make inquiries after friends and people you both know, or You ask after the family whether everybody's well. And then at the end, there's, you know, usually a while to say goodbye and so on. Those are just the beginning and the end. And then during the conversation, people are often wordy, or they bring up irrelevant details, and so on. So in many ways, an actual conversation is inefficient in comparison with a text message. And that too, I mean, I know this from my own experience. It's a way or a reason to prefer texting, say, to calling. A text could simply be, "Are you coming?" And that's all. A phone call takes much longer than that. Even if all you want to know is, "Are you coming?" Usually the conversation touches on various other things and simply takes more time. All right, so face-to-face conversation, you could say, takes more time, takes more patience, and is less efficient in a kind of utilitarian sense. A fifth point focuses on another way in which conversations, face-to-face conversations, are more demanding. They're demanding in a deeper sense. It's not just that they take more time, but they demand, you could say, our personal presence. You have to pay attention to another person. You have to be present to another person. You have to try to really listen to another person, to understand what he means. You have to try to feel yourself into what another person is saying. And that is often hard to do. Again, I think we all know what this means. To really listen, to really be present to another person is hard to do. And we also know it from the receiving end. If we want to be listened to, we want to say something to another person, we have an important communication to make, it's easy to tell that another person's not really interested, does not really have the time to sit and listen to you. And that's disturbing. And in some ways it... that's enough on that point. Sherry Turkle points out, by the way, that modern technologies make it even harder to be present to other persons. People can now be physically together with one set of persons while virtually communicating with others that are elsewhere. That are not in the room and nobody knows who they're communicating with. So this communication with other people is sort of in some ways entirely outside of the context of the real people present. Here's one paragraph from Turkle's article. She says, "At home, families sit together, texting and reading email. At work, executives text during board meetings. We text and shop and go on Facebook during classes and when we're on dates. My students even tell me about an important new skill. It involves maintaining eye contact with someone while you text someone else. It's hard, they say, but it can be done." So that fact that modern communication somehow interfere with our attempts to be present to one another in the flesh, that make this task to be present even harder. All right, that's the fifth point of contrast, that face-to-face conversation call upon us to be really present with our full personhood, so to speak, whereas virtual connections can be made while we have our mind on many other things. I can even have many text conversations going on at the same time with different people who know nothing about one another, and that are unaware of the fact that I am having these conversations with many other people. All right, the sixth contrast that I gather from these articles is that because in face-to-face conversation you are in the presence of another person, you are also vulnerable and exposed to the other in a way that you're not if you're simply sitting behind a screen and communicating through Facebook. if you are in the presence of someone, you are aware of being looked at, of being observed. You appear to the other person directly, immediately, in the flesh. So you're aware that you have to sort of behave accordingly. Yawning in front of a computer when nobody is looking, except through Facebook, so to speak, is very different. Or you can, you know, you can check your email before you're dressed, and so on. All of that you don't really do when you are in the presence of another person. So this makes real face-to-face conversations much more demanding, in a way, than mere virtual connections to another person who can't really see you, who can only read what you're texting, but that's it. Now, the seventh point is a very important one, central to both articles, and it's this, that face-to-face conversations stimulate self-reflection. There's something about conversing with another person bodily that stimulates self-knowledge, encourages a kind of reflection on my own thoughts, my own feelings, my own understanding of reality, and so on. I have a passage both from Turkle and from Scruton in connection with this point. So Turkle puts it this way. She says, "We use conversation with others to learn to converse with ourselves. So our flight from conversation into texting and emailing and so on can diminish chances to learn skills for self-reflection. These days, social media continually asks us what's on our mind, but we have little motivation to say something truly self-reflective. Self-reflection in conversation requires trust. It is hard to do anything with 3,000 Facebook friends except connect." Right? You don't reveal yourself, and therefore you don't think about yourself as deeply when you're connecting with 3,000 Facebook friends as when you're in a one-on-one conversation, or maybe a two- or three-on-one conversation with some intimate friends. Scruton says this, "The other's face is a mirror in which they see their own. Precisely because attention is fixed on the other, there is an opportunity for self-knowledge and self-discovery, for that expanding freedom in the presence of the other, which is one of the joys of human life. As traditionally conceived, friendship was ruled by the maxim, know thyself." End quote. So, for Scruton, it's this being in the presence of the other and seeing somehow myself as mediated through the face and responses of the other that leads to a deeper self-knowledge and self-conception. All right, the eighth point of contrast is also has to do with self-reflection, but for a very different reason. Face-to-face relationship encourage reflection precisely because we don't always have them. Very often we are alone. Alone by ourselves in a car, or while we're cooking dinner, or while we're on a walk, or whatever it may be. We're not always around other people. And that leaves us with plenty of time to just be by ourselves and think, reflect on our life, on what happened, on our plans, and so on. But nowadays, because it is so easy to connect with other people through cell phones and other mobile gadgets, we are rarely alone unless we make a deliberate effort. It's too easy to text someone while you're standing in line. It's you know, at the grocery store or something like that. Indeed, Turkle points out that many people no longer distinguish between solitude, which is in principle a positive thing, being alone with yourself, and loneliness, which of course is a negative. Solitude, Turkle says, is seen as a problem to be avoided, and one that can be solved through technology. Here's what she says, quote, "When people are alone, even for a few moments, they fidget and reach for a device. We think constant connection will make us feel less lonely. The opposite is true. If we are unable to be alone, we are far more likely to be lonely. If we don't teach our children to be alone, they will know only how to be lonely." All right, so this too, I think, is a very central point to both Turkle and Scruton, that the ubiquitous and always ready at hand possibility to communicate, to connect with people, in some ways has made it very hard to find times when we are alone with ourselves and sort of given time to reflect, to turn inward, you could say, and nourish our interior life. Now, all right, so having made these contrasts, again, I made 8, but it could have been another list, and there are some that I really haven't made yet that are in the articles, but perhaps I've said enough to begin to see one important reason why these new methods of instant connection are so attractive. And I'll use Turkle's phrase to put it. She says that they provide us with, quote, "the illusion of companionship without the demands and risks and messiness of relationship." All right, so there's a kind of illusion of companionship without the real demands imposed on us by in the flesh relationships. Think of it this way. These virtual ways of communicating enable us to connect without having to pay attention to the other person. We can be free to focus our attention on whatever we want while we're texting with one or many people. I can read a book, I can watch a soap opera while I'm at the same time chatting with people through Facebook or through some other means. Normally that would be offensive, I think, to people who think they're having a conversation with me. But because they don't see me, because I'm in, you know, the privacy of my own living room, I can do whatever I want, and nobody will know. We also, I mean, this is another way of amplifying this point. We can be connected and at the same time hidden behind the screen, to use the title of Scruton's article. So we can present, in some ways we hide ourselves, our real selves, and present only the self that we want to present. We can edit our words, for example, before we submit them. You know, you write something and then you rewrite it and until it's sort of perfectly polished, and then you send it off into cyberspace. Or we can remain completely anonymous. You know, you sign up for some chat room and you give yourself a name and you give yourself a picture. You can choose your gender and whatever you like. You can create a new identity for yourself and communicate at will with other people. When you get bored, you can just turn off the computer. Or when the going gets tough, you know, when the virtual relationship gets you into trouble, you can just unfriend the person, as they call it on Facebook. Or you can delete yourself and come up with a new identity and either join the same conversation or join another one. Right? So it's very easy to sort of go in and out relationships to present one identity and then another identity. Meanwhile, really you yourself are protected from the relationship in a very important way. You keep yourself hidden. You don't risk yourself in the relationship. You also don't have to, in the same way, live with the consequences of what happens in a relationship and how you behave in a relationship, right? You can just unfriend a person or quit that chat room and go somewhere else. It's all very easily done in the virtual world, but not at all easily done in the real world, or real connections with real people, family, friends, neighbors. There, if you do something wrong, you can't just delete yourself or unneighbor them. You have to live with them and live with your consequences, with the consequences of your action and the consequences of their action. All right, so real relationships, you are much more really involved. You're much more at risk, much more vulnerable, and you can't just get out of it whenever you want. So it's also true that just as you are not vulnerable, you hide yourself in the same way, in some ways, the others aren't exposed to you. Or maybe you could say the others don't really enter your space, right? Someone who's with whom I'm virtually connecting is not really in my space. He too is hiding behind the screen. He too is keeping me at bay, you could say. So both parties in the conversation retain a kind of absolute control over it. Either one can quit whenever he wants, turn off the screen whenever he wants, and in that way remain invulnerable and somehow impervious from the relationship. They're not really at risk. All right, so those are ways of amplifying this idea that Turkle expresses by saying that they give us the illusion of companionship without the demands and risks of a real relationship. All right. To sum up, I think we can now also see the danger that, according to Scruton and Turkle, these technologies pose for persons. Unless we use them wisely and in moderation, their point is, these technologies will weaken our selfhood and pervert our relationships. Weaken our selfhood and pervert our relationships. Pervert both by making them superficial and by skewing them in various ways. Here's how Turkle expresses it. This is one of the lines I love most from her article. She says this: In order to feel more and to feel more like ourselves, we connect. But in our rush to connect, we flee from solitude, our ability to be separate and gather ourselves. Lacking the capacity for solitude, we turn to other people, but we don't experience them as they are. It is as though we use them, need them as spare parts to support our increasingly fragile selves. Right, so in that quote, you see both that because of the lack of self-reflection and self-knowledge, and because of the incapacity to dwell with ourselves, to be alone, we have weakened our personhood. And that affects our relationship with others, because we somehow use others now to support us, to distract ourselves in some ways from our own fragile selves. Right, I hope that's somewhat clear, but I'd be happy to take it up in the discussion. Scruton, and here I come to the last passage I want to read here, basically gets at the same point, but he uses some interesting philosophical concepts from Hegel and Marx. He distinguishes between two ways of relating to the world, two ways of moving outwards, of transcending oneself and acting in the world. All right, let me just give you the passage and then see if it's clear. quote, "We become free only by moving outwards, embodying our freedom in shared activities and mutually responsible relations. But we must distinguish a true from a false way of moving outwards, one in which we gain our freedom by giving it real and objective form, as opposed to one in which we lose it by investing it in objects that alienate us from our inner life. The thing that we most value in human life, self-realization in a condition of freedom, is separated by a thin dividing line from the thing which destroys us, self-alienation in a condition of bondage." So, to put it in my own words, you could say Scruton says here that it's important for the human person to flourish, to move outwards, to act towards and with other people, sort of objectively in the world, you could say. But there are two ways of transcending oneself, of acting in the world, of attaching yourselves to projects in the world. One is life-giving. It makes us free. It helps us to realize ourselves, to become genuine, flourishing persons. The other is a kind of self-squandering. It's when we spend, you could say, ourselves and pursue things that aren't really worthwhile. And in a way, Scruton thinks if we give too much of ourselves and spend too much of our time and invest too much in virtual realities, in virtual relationships, then we will miss out on the real relationships, the real face-to-face encounters that alone can lead to a flowering and fulfilling and free human life. All right, let's leave it at that, and hopefully any points of clarification or whatever else can be brought up in the discussion.